From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Whitmer's emergency powers are under fire. Today we talk about the petitions aimed at putting power in legislative hands.
All of the governor's orders, they would end pretty soon, if not immediately.
Also, today, graduate students are on strike for increased COVID testing and protections at Michigan's largest university.
The University of Michigan, which has one of the largest endowments in the world, has over $6 billion in unrestricted reserves. So these are funds that they could draw on at any time without any stipulation. They have the money, it's time to use it.
And the new artistic director at Michigan Opera Theater talks about his reputation for new and transformative work.
Pushing and going out on a limb is basically my entire life. That has fueled everything that I have done.
He'll explain his move to Detroit, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The University of Michigan's grad student union is on strike over COVID conditions.
The university has continued to believe that issues of widespread testing and issues of a militarized police force on campus are not permissive subjects of bargaining, and that's been a major issue.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, petition drives to curb Governor Whitmer's executive powers are underway. Last week, organizers from one of them announced some headway. They need about 340,000 valid signatures to make the ballot. As of last Friday, they reported they'd gathered about 400,000 signatures, but they're aiming for 500,000 total. With us now to talk more about what's going on with the governor's leadership and various challenges to it is Zach Gorchow. He's the publisher of Gongwer News Service. Zach, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get some clarity first on this petition that seems to be in the lead right now. What exactly is this petition asking for?
The idea is to repeal something called the Emergency Powers of the Governor Act. It's a 1945 law that authorizes governors to declare a state of emergency. Unlike Michigan has a couple of laws on this topic, there is another law enacted in 1976 called the Emergency Management Act. Unlike the Emergency Management Act, the Emergency Powers of the Governor provides for no legislative oversight on states of emergencies. So if a governor were to declare an emergency under the 1976 law, which is how most emergencies have been handled, the emergency lasts for 28 days and can only be extended with an affirmative vote of both houses of the legislature. The legislature has made it pretty clear they didn't want to keep the emergency going for COVID-19. And that would remove the governor's ability to issue orders amending or suspending state laws. So she's been relying upon the 1945 law, which provides for no legislative oversight. And so this initiative petition, if enough signatures are gathered and if then passed by the legislature, would repeal the 1945 law, thus leaving in place the 1976 law and assuring that an emergency could only go beyond 28 days if the legislature agreed. Got all that?
Yeah, I think so. So, long story short, this is going back to challenge some somewhat Byzantine aspects of Michigan law that were made decades and decades before anybody had ever heard of COVID. Now, the petition in question was put forward by a group called Unlock Michigan, and it's not to be confused with several other petition drives to actually recall the governor. Can you tell us a little bit more about Unlock Michigan, who this is, and who might have had a hand in funding?
Well, I mean, these are Republicans. Exactly which ones, we don't have a lot of information, but they have, you know, a very well-regarded Republican firm running it. We don't really know who's funding it because under Michigan law, ballot question committees, and this is a ballot question committee, can accept corporate contributions. And most of that funding has come from a shell entity, but it's had ties to legislative Republicans for many years. You know, we may not know the exact names and entities that are funding it. It sure would be nice to know that. But these are Republicans who are doing this because the Republicans control the legislature and Governor Whitmer is a Democrat, and the Republicans of the legislature have stridently objected to her keeping Michigan under a state of emergency they really thought it should have ended in May.
Now, I guess that if the petition campaign is successful, there might not be a need to wait until 2022 to have it on the ballot. The Republican legislature might just take it up and pass it, and it could be veto-proof.
There is no intention here to go to the ballot. The idea is get this proposal before the legislature, which with its Republican majorities almost surely would approve it. It is under the Michigan Constitution, cannot be vetoed, and then would become law, and the 1945 law would be repealed. It's a deliberate quirk of our Constitution that allows voters, if a group can obtain signatures from registered voters equal to 8% of the total vote for governor in the last governor's race, it brings the proposal first to the legislature. Now, if the legislature were to not act on it, then it would go to the ballot. But the whole idea here is to get the legislature to approve it. This will not go to the ballot.
Do you have any sense if Republicans were able to negate the governor's executive powers in this way? Do you have any sense of what they might want to act on first, or what they might want to overturn of the restrictions that the governor's put on commerce and movement?
Well, one of the first things that would happen, you know, all of the governor's orders, they would end pretty soon, if not immediately. And we asked Speaker Chatfield the other day, you know, if they were ready to move on putting some of these provisions into statute, like an extension, you know, the extension of unemployment benefits from 20 to 26 weeks, or the mask mandate, you know, two of the more big, obvious orders that are out there. And he basically said they weren't going to speculate, and they would just sort of wait and see what happens, that they were ready to partner with the governor. I think it will be really interesting to see what happens, because I think if the governor's powers are repealed, the very first thing you're going to see is an enormous pressure campaign brought by the Democrats against the Republicans on things like unemployment benefits and masks and several other of the governor's orders that are very popular. And you're going to see a lot of pressure brought on the legislature to immediately put some of these things into law, because if they don't, there's no legal mechanism to enforce them at that point.
Zach Gorchow is the publisher of Gong War News Service. Zach, thank you so much for the update.
Well, thanks for having me.
Michigan Opera Theater announced a major coup last week. The company's new artistic director is going to be Yuval Sharon, a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant who's won rave reviews for staging thought-provoking performances around the world. His first official act in Detroit will tell you a lot about the kind of director he is. It's a condensed staging of Wagner's Twilight of the Gods, featuring soprano Christine Gerke. It's a sign of Yuval Sharon's reputation that he can draw a singer of Gerke's caliber, but the staging of this production will be unlike anything Detroit audiences have seen. It's a drive-in performance, set at a Detroit Opera House parking structure with a full performance simulcast via car radio. Are you getting a sense of Yuval Sharon's creative imagination? He joins us now for a longer conversation. Yuval Sharon, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
I know you grew up in Chicago. Will you tell me a little bit about the first opera that you ever experienced in person?
Yes, actually. Well, my first opera was not at Lyric Opera of Chicago, although I did see a lot of my early operas there. My first opera was actually in an opera company in Germany when my dad was working at an engineering firm there. I went to visit him and we went to the opera because, you know, that's what you do when you're in Germany. You know, every German town has its own little opera company. They were doing La Traviata, and this was in the time before super titles.
So you were hearing it in the original Italian.
Yes,
all the way.
Exactly. It was in the original Italian. It was a, you know, conventional production, but I did not know it at all what was going on. And you know, the music was really interesting at times, but I felt a little bit like I was observing some sort of alien culture. I didn't really know what was going on stage or what was happening, and so I actually felt quite alienated from opera as a first experience.
So that was your first brush with traditional opera. What was the first time you saw a production that maybe awakened your sense of possibility for what this medium could be?
Yeah, I mean, the production that did awaken my sense of possibility was, in a way, I hate to say it, but it was actually a kind of negative, a negative awakening to the possibility, which was a production that I saw at the San Francisco Opera. This is when I was studying at UC Berkeley and started going to the opera on my own, which was an indication that it was starting, you know, opera was starting to really kind of grow for me and as an interest. And I started attending, and it was a production of the opera by Alban Berg called Wozzeck, which is a 20th century opera. It is a 90-minute piece, incredibly spiky, difficult, and dark, and yet harrowing and powerful and unforgettable. This was a really big turning point for me because this was the first opera where I bought a recording of it and listened to it at home. And so I had this opportunity to listen to the music at home and start to imagine what it could be. And the experience of the music, just listening to it over headphones, was so big and so overwhelming. So when I went to see it at the theater, it was kind of a disappointment, and you know, nothing bad about San Francisco Opera. It just so happened that this was kind of an older production. It was a production that felt maybe like it didn't really get the time and attention that a piece that's like that really deserves. And so the whole thing felt a little bit, let's say, under-investigated. You know, there is this feeling when I was sitting at home that this is a piece that felt like it could completely change your entire worldview. And instead, it felt like a rather routine experience. And that's when I started to understand the potential of the stage director, actually, because I started to realize that it was the visual and the performative aspect of it that wasn't speaking to me. The music was performed beautifully, but the presentation of it, the language on stage, the acting, the stagecraft, all of those things just did not feel like they were at the same level as the music or the text. And that's when I started to think, I wonder what would happen if you started to think about these operas the way that we think about theatrical pieces and the role that a theater director plays in truly electrifying the work and making an electric connection between the stage and the audience.
Don't go away. We're back in just a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with Yuval Sharon, the renowned opera director taking the helm at Michigan Opera Theater. He's developed a reputation as a disruptor in the opera world. And we discussed how he hopes to elevate MOT status both within opera circles and within the community that it serves. Let's pick it up from there. Could you tell us about maybe the first time you decided to step out on a limb in an operatic setting, you know, making a production choice that was kind of atypical, and how you figured out something that would support the story rather than detract from it? I mean, we're living in an era where opera can and is sometimes influenced by everything from like telenovelas to Cirque du Soleil. And there are many technical things that are possible in terms of staging now that weren't at all possible when works in the canon were written. Tell us about a time when you just decided to push.
I think that pushing and going out on a limb is basically my entire life. That has fueled everything that I have done, because I think one of the things that really inspired me about opera, at least my idea of what opera could be, is that it is something so much larger than life and so much, let me put it this way. You know, opera in many ways is a truly audacious art form, because it really brings together all of these different artists from all of these walks of life to create something that no one could do on their own. So at the core of opera is collaboration. It's thinking about the many, many art forms that create something brand new out of a lot of pre-existing elements. So it's not just music. It's not just a concert. It's not just a theater piece. It's not just a fashion show. It's not just a poem. It's kind of all of these things.
At the
and
same
none
time.
Of them.
Yeah.
At the same time, exactly. And I think that I, from the very beginning, I thought, you know, if I'm going to get involved in opera, I want to explore that because that feels so contemporary. And that feels like that's a way of thinking about opera that is both, I think, at the origins of what opera always was, and also, I think, the clearest path forward for its future. So to choose one moment where I've stepped out on a limb might be a little hard for me because I think that that is something that you know, I've tried to do on each and every one of my projects in potentially larger and larger ways, you know, as I've gotten more support and and more possibilities and more experience, I've been continually trying to push the envelope, and that is certainly, you know, I'm bringing that entire attitude with me here to Detroit as well, and thinking about opera in Detroit and how I actually really think that Detroit offers such an amazing landscape for truly thinking about the next step of opera's future.
Can you give us a little comparison of the company that you've been running in Los Angeles called The Industry?
Yeah.
Is sort of mid-sized in the LA ecosystem. Can you give us a comparison of these two organizations just so we understand sort of where we're coming from?
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually, I'm honored that you would think that our very very small artist-driven organization deserves the designation of mid-size. I think of it as actually a quite, you know, entrepreneurial and small institution that we are actually actively trying to grow and make sure that it transcends the kind of founder syndrome that a lot of arts organizations sometimes face when it's kind of led by an artist. That's a kind of a separate story. I'll simply say that coming into the Michigan Opera Theater in Detroit is certainly a step up. I mean, Michigan Opera Theater is definitely a mid-sized organization. You know, that is, I think, a very good designation for an organization of this size. So the thing that I feel very connected to when I think about the history of Michigan Opera Theater and its founder, David DiChiara, you know, he was, you know, an entrepreneur just like me. You know, I think when I came to LA and said, I want to start my own company for experimental operas where we're going to do operas in warehouses and train stations and moving cars and all of these kind of things, you know, everyone looked at me like I was crazy. And people still do, but little by little, more and more people have gotten the message and have jumped on the bandwagon, which has been great. And I think that David DiChiara must have been very similar when he started. Of course, he wasn't talking about doing operas in unconventional settings. His dream was really establishing an opera company that would have a home like the Detroit Opera House, which is such a magnificent theater. But, you know, I think considering where Detroit was when he was pushing to make opera happen here, I feel a real kinship with that because I just went through that in Los Angeles, you know what that takes. And I know what that, you know, there was a beautiful obituary for him by Mark Stryker in the Detroit Free Press that called him a kind of Pied Piper. And that, you know, that story could have some negative connotations, but I know that what Mark meant was a very positive one, which is how to get everyone galvanized by a vision for what opera could be for a city or a, you know, community for which opera might feel like it doesn't seem to make sense, you know, that these notions of opera as, you know, a colonialist and elitist kind of art form, that those things, we don't have to carry those associations with us anymore. We can actually try and create a kind of American identity for what opera is and one that really resonates with the city of Detroit. And I think that knowing that that was David's mission, that feels to me like exactly the kind of thing that I want to renew for this new era and for this new time.
So we're talking about two organizations on very different scale. I want to say that the number of paid employees that you had at The Industry was like two or three.
Correct.
In terms of
correct.
Salaried folks. And and when we're talking about Michigan Opera Theater, I mean, I think this includes contractors. Their numbers are in the hundreds. So that would include musicians and singers and you know, design people and other things. I wondered, as you pondered this move to Michigan, what seemed potentially more frightening, trying to ride out the situation in Los Angeles with this, you know, this small company that you'd founded, or making a leap into, coming back to the Midwest, you know, a terrain you're familiar with, but a place that's in a very different place economically than LA is right now.
I mean, I should say that I am keeping a foot in Los Angeles, and I will be continuing my work with the industry, which is my company. But we'll be changing our leadership structure to allow for me to do both. The main thing I'm personally cutting out of my schedule is all of the freelance directing that I've done, in some amazing theaters all around the world. But I have to say that the main thing that drew me to Detroit, and the reason why I feel like it's very easy for me to give up those opportunities of places like Berlin and Vienna and the like, is because I am most interested and really most passionate about how to connect opera to a community, or communities, I think is a better way to put it. You know, there's so many fascinating and rich communities that make up Detroit that all have incredible stories, incredible histories that should be reflected on the stage of the Opera House, or even outside the stage of the Opera House. But part of the art that this company does should certainly reflect who makes up Detroit. And that's something actually that is a very key part of my work in Los Angeles, and has been a tremendously rewarding experience in Los Angeles. That ability to work again and again with the same group of people, to really get to know a city, get to know the people that make up the city, and to be creating work for those people and with those people. And to have that opportunity here in Detroit, you're right, the economics are different. But I think this notion of really connecting with the people that make up Detroit, and thinking about work that really resonates with the people here, is an incredible opportunity. And I think will be enormously rewarding. It's not me just coming in, doing one project, and then, and then leaving, but actually making a sustained effort over the course of several years to truly interact with this community. And I hope the result is a situation in which the DNA of this organization really does evolve and become something that opera can take its place alongside Motown, jazz, and techno as part of the incredible musical legacy of the city.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Yuval Sharon. He's the new artistic director at Michigan Opera Theater. You know, many American opera companies have struggled over the past couple of decades with the expectations of the patrons they rely on for, you know, classic works in the repertoire. And the interest that a lot of directors and a lot of artists have in doing work that pushes the envelope a little bit more. Are you convinced that balance can be struck in Detroit?
Yes, I am convinced, because I got to meet a lot of the patrons here. And there is, of course, a core group of people who really love the traditional repertoire. And so do I. my favorite opera is Magic Flute. And I can't wait to do that here in Detroit. So I am certainly committed to presenting those pieces. I just think that the time is right to investigate those pieces in a brand new way, so that people don't have the experience that I had when I went to see Wozzeck in San Francisco, of feeling like, you know, this music was great, but I actually liked it better when I sat in my room and listened to it. You know, the experience of coming to the theater and with all of the other elements should take your experience of the music and expand on it and make it larger. So that's what I think we can really do, including opening up these pieces to truly speak to the world that we're in right now. And that can sometimes be a little controversial. I think sometimes people think it comes from a distrust of the music. And I think that's not the case at all. I think it's actually because of a true love of this music, we want to let it speak to every audience and let it really speak to our time, because these pieces really can speak to our time in ways that are really powerful. The music will always stay the same, but the visuals, you know, get renewed every time. And I think that's where the classic repertoire has still an enormous amount of potential. So in presenting myself, introducing myself to board members and to patrons here, there are certainly the people that are really excited for big change. There are people who are maybe more worried about what change might look like, but in conversations, I think understand that it's change that is more focused on evolution and from a real, real respect and love for this material. And I think once they can hear that, and once they know that the beloved pieces will come back, just, you know, in a different guise, that I think that they feel really won over. I also have to say that I've been sensing from everyone that I've been speaking to in Detroit that everyone understands that this is a very serious paradigm shift that we're experiencing right now in our world. And for opera to survive, it will also have to adapt. It will really have to look and feel and sound different after we can come back in the theater. Otherwise, it will risk feeling kind of irrelevant and outdated. And I don't believe that's the case with opera, but I think we have to make a very strong case now for it, because otherwise I don't see how it's going to make it.
Another thing that's happening in the opera ecosystem right now is the fact that every local company is, at least to some extent, in competition with a company like the Metropolitan Opera, which offers a Netflix-like subscription of its simulcasts. You can log on and you can watch really top-drawer productions anytime, day or night now. How does that affect your approach to what you have to offer in a live performance?
Yeah, it's such a great point. You know, I think there is, on one hand, an enormous gauntlet that's been thrown down to every single company in America once the Met started broadcasting in HD. And like you said, offering it a la carte, you know, in the comfort of your own home, and previously in the comfort of your own theater, a movie theater, I should say. So this has really, I think it opens up so much potential for each local company. I think the reason that local companies have struggled as soon as these HD broadcasts have started to become so widely disseminated is because a lot of the companies are basically trying to do the same thing as the Met. The productions kind of look the same. You know, they don't necessarily have a really, for the most part, I'm speaking very generally, but, you know, there isn't always a really strong point of view on exactly the same kind of repertoire that they can see in a much more comfortable and much more affordable scenario. And with these top-notch singers, okay, you know, they're digitally compressed and you're not hearing the sound in three dimensions, but, you know, there's got to be a more compelling reason to come into the theater. And for me, the answer to this, and this is what I am very excited to explore here in Detroit, is that the opera here must look and feel and sound like no other city in the country. It has to be something that is so clearly a Detroit opera. Then I think it completely complements in the most wonderful way the kind of work that gets disseminated, not just from the Met Opera, but now, you know, the Vienna Staatsoper, and, you know, all of these other institutions now are so easily accessible to us. And in fact, they're so easily accessible that we kind of forget how magical opera can be. And so I think when I think about live performance, certainly as we're struggling to figure out how to make live performance happen again in these strange conditions, for me, the liveness of it is paramount and is so important. I'll definitely be looking for ways to make sure audiences can experience it safely while they might be worried without a vaccine. So they still have access to it, but I can't imagine supplanting the electricity and the excitement of a live performance just through these digital platforms.
Yuval Sharon's first production with Michigan Opera Theater is a drive-in adaptation of Wagner's Twilight of the Gods called Twilight Gods, October 17th through 20th. Yuval, I know we've got to let you go, but in a word or two, what should we expect?
I think expect the unexpected, I guess, you know. I love introducing myself to the Detroit audience with a piece like this, because I hope people will have this feeling, you know, to go back to your question about what it was like to watch an opera when I was, you know, 13 and watching La Traviata. I think to myself, well, the 13-year-old me, if I was experiencing opera moving through this parking center and seeing these singers and instrumentalists on all of these different levels to create this kind of immersive experience, if that was my first experience of opera, I would have fallen in love with opera so much faster than I already have. So I really hope that there is this feeling of a piece that feels really deeply connected to the time that we're in, that really looks to connect the classic repertoire in a brand new experience as an opportunity to think about what the future of the art form can look like, not just here in Detroit, but maybe across the country.
Yuval Sharon is the incoming artistic director at Michigan Opera Theater. Hey, Yuval, welcome to Michigan. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to come back.
In just a moment, we're going to catch up with the grad student strike on the University of Michigan's campus, where TAs are refusing to teach in protest of COVID policies.
UM has a lot of money in the endowment. We're in an emergency right now. It's time to dip into that fund and make sure that our community and campus is safe.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The University of Michigan Graduate Employees Organization, or GEO, is one of the oldest graduate student unions in the country. Its members have advocated for jobs, healthcare, and other issues during many tumultuous times. Members have been on strike for a week now due to concerns over the university's COVID-19 regulations. On Friday, September 11th, GEO held a community event where speakers discussed their demands and concerns about university response to COVID. Stateside production assistant Catherine Nguyen was there, and she joins us now. Catherine, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
What was the vibe like at the demonstration last week?
Yeah, so it was very high energy. Lots of people were repping the merchandise of GEO, wearing masks and shirts with the logo on it. There was social distancing and lots of speakers at the event. And after the speakers, everyone left the union and went headed over to Alice Lloyd, where there's a large dining hall. Alice Lloyd is a dorm and also has a dining hall, and many of the dining hall staff were staging a walkout in solidarity with the GEO.
What kinds of things were the speakers at Friday's event talking about?
Yeah, so they were talking about the lack of testing that's occurring on campus. According to the university's COVID-19 dashboard, there's only been about 3,300 tests that have been administered in the past 14 days. And the total undergraduate population at the university is over 30,000. So many union organizers are calling for mandatory and randomized testing. Speakers were also denouncing the existence of the Michigan Ambassadors Program, which is a program where students or faculty can volunteer to report COVID violations, such as large gatherings without masks. And union organizers are trying to take away the connection for the university to be with the Ann Arbor Police Department. And they are originally going to be accompanying the Michigan Ambassadors when they would be breaking up events that were in violation of COVID regulations. So actually, the speaker of the Black Student Union, Thomas Vance, touched on this point specifically.
The GSIs are mad because their demands are not being met. The BSU, the Arab Students Association, La Casa, and the United Asian American Organizations are mad because the Michigan Ambassador Program still exists. They bug you. Yep. We are all collectively mad, so let's be collectively mad together.
Again, that's Thomas Vance of the Black Student Union at the University of Michigan. Catherine, could you hazard a guess at how many people were there and just what kind of folks showed up?
Yeah, there were definitely over 100 people at the event. It spanned from undergraduate students to the graduate union organizers and lecturers that were there. LEO, which is the Lecturers Employee Organization, also another union on campus, is actually in support of the strike. And in addition to that, residential advisors or RAs from dorms have gone on strike in solidarity with GEO, as well as some of the M Dining staff.
Are there specific concerns that some of those participants had about what's going on?
Yeah, so lots of people were complaining about the inadequate conditions of the facilities where students are forced to quarantine. It's at Northwood, which is an apartment complex on North Campus.
Yeah, and there were a number of TikTok videos I saw making the rounds over the weekend of students who were quarantined there.
Yes, yes, exactly. So they weren't given microwaves to warm up delivered food, and they were being delivered in packages that weren't oven safe. So a lot of people had to eat cold food, and they weren't given bed sheets to sleep with and weren't told to bring bed sheets with them. There's also no laundry at the facilities that they can access. So there are a few concerns that they have. Also, some undergraduate students told me that they were encouraged to fake symptoms in order to receive tests because the University Health Service only is testing students who are showing symptoms. So Trent Engel, an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, was telling me more about that.
UHS, the University Health System, which is what they're trying to advocate most of their testing and refer students to, they will only accept you for testing if you show symptoms. And they've gotten, actually, I've tried to get tested because I live in a large shared community. And because of that, I've not been symptomatic this entire time, but I've been encouraged by my housemates to fake symptoms in order to get testing because, they did reject me. Faking symptoms, help you get a test. And because of that, you can have a sense of security. So that's why a lot of people do it.
That's Trent Engel, who's been quarantined at Northwood. Our reporting today came from stateside production assistant Catherine Nguyen. Catherine, thanks for bringing us this.
Yes, of course.
Joining us now for more on the negotiations are Amir Fleischman, the secretary of GEO, and Aaron Markowitz, vice president for GEO. Aaron, Amir, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Being that this is only the second time GEO has called a strike, it must have been a pretty huge decision. Can you tell us about the specific issues that tipped the scale?
Sure. So there were two big categories of demands that were motivating our action. The first is responding to the university's reckless pandemic reopening plan, their totally inadequate testing levels, and lack of attention to needs of graduate students generally and specific groups of graduate students, such as parents and international students. The second thing is the uprisings against racist police violence going on all over the country this summer. Anti-policing is something that GEO has been working on for years. But seeing the movements around the summer really inspired us and I think galvanized a lot of our members. We really would not have been able to make the progress we have without the work done by African-American activists over the summer.
It's our impression that the classes that GEO members would normally be teaching are just not going forward at this moment. Is that your understanding of how the university is handling it?
Yeah, for the most part.
What were the conversations with the university like prior to the start of the academic year?
Well, we've been in conversations with the university about their COVID response going back to April during the last semester. And over the course of the summer, these conversations have taken the form of informal conversations with HR over the phone to impact bargaining with the entire academic HR team, as well as conversations with the regents. So these conversations centered on issues that they believe were permissive subjects of bargaining. These are typically issues of health and safety as the university sees them, but the university has continued to believe that issues of widespread testing and issues of a militarized police force on campus are not permissive subjects of bargaining. And that's been a major issue for GEO because we believe that the only safe workplace is a demilitarized one, and the issue of police violence is actually a labor issue. So that was a major issue that came up in these conversations and led to us going on strike.
As you've mentioned, one of the concerns that you wanted to raise right now was this issue of campus police, how they are equipped and how they're trained. Why did you feel like that was an important issue to press the university on in this moment when, frankly, there are a lot of other things going on?
Yeah, so we view our policing demands as inseparable from our pandemic demands. Mm-hmm. They're related really, really clearly in the fact that the university, in this time of, you know, uprisings against racist police violence all over the country, and when comparable institutions like the University of Minnesota are cutting ties with law enforcement, the University of Michigan's actually expanding ties with local law enforcement in a perverse attempt to enforce social distancing.
Could you explain what's going on?
Yeah. So they've started this program called the Michigan Ambassadors Program, where they essentially are requesting students and community members sign up to essentially be vigilantes going around campus and the neighborhoods in Ann Arbor and policing students and anybody else who might be violating social distance. So this is just flies in the face of everything we know about community safety and what is actually expecting to happen. We may remember from back, I believe, in July, the story about Amy Cooper in Central Park calling the cops on an African-American man who was just minding his own business, specifically because she knows that the cops will come and do harm to him based on his race.
So your concern is that community policing, as the university puts it, would adversely affect social gatherings where people of color are present in numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. We view this as essentially empowering community members with sort of a license to harass Black and brown students.
The university administration has taken a look at what you've asked them for, and among many other things, has agreed to make public the surveillance testing capacity, as well as the actual number of tests performed. It has agreed to some expansion, although I believe not everything you asked for in terms of child care subsidies for students with kids, and some more help for international students. Looking at all of their responses to what you've been negotiating about, how far do you think the university has come toward meeting you?
They still have a ways to go. Last Wednesday, our membership voted overwhelmingly to reject their offer because it didn't give us anything on our policing demands, and it did not give us a real expansion of testing, which is one of the main things we're looking for, which is super important for our entire community. And I just want to add that what we're asking for in terms of testing is incredibly reasonable. If we look at comparable institutions like Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, they have approximately a quarter of UM's student population, yet in their first week back, they tested around 10 times as many students. So this is well within the realm of possibility, what we're asking. UM has a lot of money in the endowment. We're in an emergency right now. It's time to dip into that fund and make sure that our community and campus is safe.
Is it difficult to get information right now about testing? How are you finding out what you need to know?
Unfortunately, the university has not been straightforward when it has come to communicating their testing procedures. Thankfully, we have a team of researchers in the union who have been looking into these procedures very closely, and some of our members have actually gone through the testing process that the University of Michigan is currently using to identify outbreaks on campus. And they have found that the testing procedures do not adequately control for selection into treatment. And it's very concerning, given their firsthand experiences, that the university is not correcting for selection into treatment, which makes it hard to actually know the risk of coronavirus on campus.
The university filed an unfair labor practice charge against the union. Is that going to affect the strike in any way?
We have been in conversations with AFT lawyers and are not willing to sort of discuss that specifics, but we are very confident that we are mobilized and our strike will continue forward in light of those legal proceedings.
I'd also add that we have in our contract provisions about a safe workplace, and I would hope that the university is meeting its expectations there as well.
Can you tell us anything about how the strike is affecting members right now?
Yeah, so I think members are fairly energized. We held a strike reauthorization ballot over the weekend. We had 80% of those who voted to extend the strike for another week. And I think people are fired up about our demands. Aaron and I are out there on the picket lines. It's really incredible to see. There's a lot of energy out there. Other groups on campus are coming out in support of us. We had a letter over the weekend signed by, I think, nearly 600 faculty now. The resident advisors at the University of Michigan are now also on strike over the incredibly unsafe conditions that they're facing in the dorms. Dining workers are also organizing because they're not treated fairly either. This is really turning into a movement.
How long do you think the members can realistically continue the strike? This is an economically perilous time for a lot of people.
I think we're ready to be out there for as long as it takes, because these demands are life and death for us and for the entire community. Multiple University of Michigan workers have already died of coronavirus. Over the summer, because of layoffs at the hospital and increased pressures on the still existing staff there, two nurses died by suicide. This is incredibly serious, and that is why we're on strike right now. I know I speak on behalf of all GEO members when I say that we care deeply about our students, and we don't take this decision lightly. So we're really prepared to go to the mat on this issue.
Are you aware of any university workers' deaths outside of Michigan Medicine?
Yes, I believe that one of the five deaths that I mentioned was of a UM bus driver. Mm.
Do you have any concerns about the university maybe turning to instructors qualified in different ways if the strike goes into an extended period of time?
I think there's always a concern during labor actions that they'll bring in temp workers. That said, graduate students are very highly specialized labor that also receives a very low wage. So it's very hard for us to replace us, especially given the current workload it takes to run in-person, hybrid, and online classes. So we are not necessarily concerned that temp labor will be able to overcome the obstruction graduate students are causing through striking.
I mean, at this point, I believe even public schools are hard-pressed to find substitutes of various qualifications for public schools throughout Michigan, so it's easy to see that it might be even more difficult in the university environment. The University of Michigan has been under some pressures in the broader world to do things like bring football back or bring face-to-face teaching back to campus in greater numbers. Do you have any reason to think that there may be financial incentives or political reasons why the university needs to try to show concern for people who want face-to-face instruction, but at the same time, maybe they would welcome a chance to keep things in the virtual world for the time being?
I don't think we can speak to the university's intent behind these policies. What we can speak to is that these policies are insufficient and grossly inadequate to ensuring the safety of our community.
Over the summer, a group of campus unions, including GEO and our sibling union, the Lecturers Union, commissioned a study by Professor Howard Bunces of, I think, EMU, that looked into the university's finances. And he found that the University of Michigan, which has one of the largest endowments in the world, has over $6 billion in unrestricted reserves. So these are funds that they could draw on at any time without any stipulation in order to fund the activities of the campus, to prevent layoffs, to ensure that we have adequate health and safety precautions taking place on campus. My office is in a building called the Haven Hall, which is a really big building. It's kind of like four buildings stuck together. If you walk into the lobby, there is not a single hand sanitizer dispenser on the first floor. Class has been in session. This is the third week. What is going on? There is really no good reason that the university could give for not having these kinds of basic safety precautions in place. They have the money. It's time to use it.
We've been talking with Amir Fleischman, who's the secretary of the University of Michigan's graduate employee organization, and with Aaron Markowitz, who's the vice president of GEO. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us again. It really is nice being able to talk about these issues.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
We reached out to the university for a comment or response to the grad students and haven't heard back as of this broadcast. If we do receive a reply, we'll post it at our website, michiganradio.org. We should mention that the University of Michigan holds Michigan Radio's broadcast license. And that's our show for today. Producers of Stateside include Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Interns are Catherine Newen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you at this time tomorrow.